The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm assuming a majority of folks listening to this are familiar with the February 1974 murder of Carla Jan Walker. If you are not familiar and feel so inclined, stop this now, go back and listen to our very first episode titled Carla Walker, Part 1, Carla's Story, and then our update released on September 27th, 2020, titled The Abduction and Murder of Carla Walker, The Impact of the Arrest and Honoring Carla's Memory. That should get you up to speed. However, for those of you who are not familiar and don't feel like going back, I'll start this episode with a brief summary of the case before getting into the pretrial of her accused rapist and killer, Glenn Samuel McCurley. On Saturday, February 16, 1974, 17-year-old Carla Walker and her 18-year-old boyfriend, Rodney McCoy, left the Valentine's Day dance at their school, Western Hills High. They drove around with another couple, doing the things that teenagers do, before dropping the other couple back off at their car at the high school. Carla and Rodney drove around some more before stopping at Ridgely Brunswick Bowling Alley on Benbrook Highway in West Fort Worth so Carla could use the restroom. It was now some time after midnight. The day had turned to Saturday, February 17th. The couple returned to Rodney's car. He slid across the bench seat to Carla on the passenger side, and the two began kissing. Suddenly, the passenger side door was jerked open, and a strange man was pulling Carla from the vehicle. Rodney attempted to thwart the man's attack, but was pistol-whipped and froze when the perpetrator pointed the gun in his face and said confidently with a strong Texas drawl, "I'm going to kill you." The man pulled the trigger, but the gun only clicked. It was jammed. The perpetrator proceeded to bludgeon Rodney in the head as he controlled Carla at the same time. Rodney began bleeding profusely and lost consciousness just as he heard Carla tell the strange man, "Stop hitting him. I'll go with you if you stop hitting him." Several minutes passed before Rodney came to, and by that time Carla was gone, abducted by a predator who had chosen his prey and struck while they were at their most vulnerable. But a piece of evidence was left behind to be discovered when police arrived. A magazine from a .22 Ruger handgun. Rodney rushed to Carla's home to tell her folks what had happened. Police were called and a massive search effort was conducted over the next 3.5 days on Wednesday, February 20th at 6:35 p.m. when Fort Worth Police Patrolman Steve Noonkester and Daryl Thompson discovered Carla's body in a culvert under a road near Benbrook Lake, about 10 miles from where she was abducted. Carla Walker had been raped and strangled. The initial investigation was extensive. Suspects were found and eliminated. One suspect was a 31-year-old man named Glenn Samuel McCurley. He was identified because he owned a .22 Ruger handgun, the only one, in fact, not accounted for in the investigation because conveniently, McCurley told the police, it had been stolen weeks earlier. But the cops had nothing else on the guy, so his name was buried deep in the file. So deep, in fact, the subsequent investigations for the next 46 years at the hands of cold case detectives either missed him completely or dismissed him as a suspect. Again, there was nothing on the guy except that he had the only missing weapon of that type in town. In 2019, Fort Worth cold case detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett reopened Carla's case and began sending out to labs items still in evidence for DNA testing. A company in California called Siri was able to pull DNA from Carla's bra. The DNA was uploaded into FBI's CODIS, or Combined DNA Index System, but it got no hits. The DNA extract created at CIRI in California made it into the hands of Woodlands, Texas lab, Othram Incorporated, and they identified a surname through genealogical research, McCurley. That name, of course, was in the file, a man who'd been questioned in the initial investigation, as described above. Long story short, Detectives Wagner and Bennett zeroed in on Glenn Samuel McCurley. Trash was taken from his bin that was on the curb for collection. DNA was found on a McDonald's straw in that trash, and it matched the DNA found on Carla's bra. And McCurley voluntarily allowed detectives to take a DNA sample directly from him after that. That too matched, and on September 21st, Glenn Samuel McCurley was arrested and charged. A grand jury indicted then 77-year-old McCurley in November of 2020. The indictment reads that McCurley, quote, on or about the 17th day of February 1974, did intentionally cause the death of Carla Walker by strangling her by a means which is unknown to the grand jury, and the said defendant was in the course of committing, or attempting to commit, the offense of aggravated rape against Carla Walker. End quote. A few weeks before the grand jury's decision, Andrew Greenstein of KRLD arranged to interview the accused killer at the Lon Evans Correction Center in downtown Fort Worth. McCurley told Greenstein that he was drinking beer in the parking lot of the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley, and he saw Rodney McCoy, Carla's boyfriend, hitting her in his car. He opened the car door and knocked him off of her, McCurley told Greenstein in an attempt to soften his role in his recollection to come, and perhaps paint himself as some kind of a good guy. McCurley went on to say that he and Carla talked some and she calmed down, thanked him for saving the day. He said, quote, she just gave me a hug, I gave her a kiss, I mistook her for something else, I didn't mean to do it. The thing he didn't mean to do was rape and strangle to death the 17-year-old Western Hills High School student. McCurley's attempt at lessening his role in the crime, of course, is utter bullshit. It's nonsensical. On Wednesday, June 16, 2021, I attended the pretrial of Glenn Samuel McCurley. Tarrant County Criminal Court 1 was mostly full. Carla Walker's brother Jim and sister Cindy were among the attendees, sitting to Judge Elizabeth Beach's right, the state's side, while Glenn McCurley's wife and son sat behind him. McCurley was masked up, wearing his forest green Tarrant County jumpsuit, and he was brought out in a wheelchair, the scene oddly reminiscent of the videos and photos I've seen of the Golden State Killer's courtroom appearances. I imagine defense portraying clients such as McCurley and D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, as pitiful, frail old men in an attempt to garner sympathy is relatively common. Anyway, the following accounts of the day's proceedings aren't necessarily in the order in which they occurred. Assistant Criminal District Attorneys Kim Davignon and Emily Dixon argued for the state. Greenstein's jailhouse interview with the accused killer was among the several motions to suppress filed by McCurley's defense attorneys, Stephen Meyer and J. Eric Nichols. On the stand, Andrew Greenstein explained to the court that he simply called jailers and asked for an interview with McCurley. He came down to the jailhouse, and because he could tell right away he wouldn't be able to hear the accused killer clearly through the clear plastic partition that separated them, Greenstein explained, he asked a deputy to place a recording device on McCurley's side. The deputy agreed, but this was no quick task. He had to travel down an elevator, get through secure access, travel back up the elevator, and place the recording device there. Judge Beach listened to the defense's argument, which was basically that law enforcement had procured the interview and that McCurley could have thought Greenstein himself was a cop. Defense argued that Greenstein's press badge could have been mistaken for police identification, which sounded as absurd at the proceeding as it does to sit here and say it out loud. They attempted to persuade Greenstein into admitting that McCurley could have mistaken him for law enforcement, but the reporter more or less insisted that it was unlikely. Defense also cited Greenstein's trouble hearing McCurley through the partition as further evidence that the accused might not have heard him announce himself as a reporter, and thus he could have mistaken him for a cop. The motion filed by defense argues that McCurley wasn't read Miranda rights, and since Greenstein was acting as an agent of law enforcement, he was not. It was a violation of the Texas Constitution. There were a lot of time-consuming and hypothetical could-haves being argued by the defense, and to be fair, that is their job, but the arguments fell far short of convincing. Judge Beach denied the motion to exclude the jailhouse interview. When Detective Leah Wagner took the stand, things didn't get much better for the defense. Likely, if you followed Carla Walker's case, you are well aware of the diligence and determination of Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett. They both worked Carla's case tirelessly and with great care. But at the pretrial, the defense called into question the interrogation of Glenn Samuel McCurley. More specifically, they argued that McCurley didn't understand or waive his right to remain silent and his right to have counsel present. The state called Detective Leah Wagner to the stand. Those of us in attendance were teased with a little more than 10 minutes of the 4-hour interrogation footage in which McCurley continually skirts around the questions, "Do you understand your rights?" and "Do you waive your rights?" after they were read to him in full. Virtually every time he's asked, he answers by saying he didn't do anything. Both Detectives Wagner and Bennett repeatedly ask to no avail, and because of that, the defense attempted to have the entire confession, which unfortunately we did not get to see, thrown out. McCurley's representation seemed to be alluding that he was confused by what was happening and didn't understand his rights. But here's the thing, McCurley might not have said the words, "Yes, I waive my rights," but the state and the witness said he certainly kept talking and eventually confessed. Again, we didn't get to see that part, so we don't know if Glenn Samuel McCurley's confession to police matches the story he told KRLD news reporter Andrew Greenstein. Judge Beach eventually ruled that McCurley's inability to shut up during interrogation was the same thing as waiving his rights, considering, she said, the totality of the circumstances, of which there are more. It was clear as day that Detectives Wagner and Bennett were doing absolutely nothing to coerce the man into giving a statement. The defense, however, was sure to bring up something that they alluded was a form of coercion. A little over a month before the pretrial, the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office took the death penalty off the table. Now that might be neither here nor there as far as the following goes, but it is something to take note of. During a later section of interrogation footage, which was recorded shortly after his arrest in September 2020, by the way, McCurley can be heard saying that he was afraid he was going to get the electric chair. At one point, he said something to the effect of, "I don't want to be hung." Detective Wagner tells McCurley that that won't happen. The defense argued that the detective was making a promise, one that wasn't hers to make, that assured McCurley he wouldn't get the death penalty. This suggested, the defense alluded, that detectives had used a coercive technique to obtain the confession. The state and Detective Wagner argued that the electric chair and the gallows no longer exist in Texas as a method of execution, which, of course, is true. The last time Texas used Old Sparky, as it was unfortunately known, was on July 30, 1964, when they executed by electrocution Joseph Johnson Jr., who had killed a grocer during a robbery. The last time a man legally swung from the gallows was way back on August 31st, 1923, when Nathan Lee was executed for killing another farmer he owed money to. Anyway, the defense wouldn't relent. They continued to insist that Detective Wagner was promising he wasn't going to face the death penalty just to get him to talk. The defense argument was bullshit. The detective never said anything about the death penalty. Judge Beach obviously agreed, and the motion to exclude the confession was denied. It'll be interesting to hear the confession at trial. In the interrogation footage, as a side note, detectives slide a photo of Carla to McCurley, and he can be heard adamantly denying ever having seen her. "I don't know the girl," he said. The McCurley defense also tried to get a search warrant thrown out on the grounds of a technicality that seems to not have existed in the first place. Getting the warrant excluded, of course, would include all evidence collected during its execution, which we do not know the extent of. Early in the pretrial hearings, the state called attorney and judge pro tempore Kim Catalano. Catalano is who signed off on the warrant to search the McCurley home, and the defense argued that, as a pro tem judge, a fill-in, she was not authorized to do so legally. The motion to exclude the search warrant, if memory serves, was denied faster than any of the other defense motions. Basically, the defense argued that because Catalano was acting as a substitute judge when she signed the warrant was invalid. Catalano, they said, wasn't a municipal court judge, not an authorized magistrate. It was learned while she was on the stand, however, that while a pro tempore judge, Catalano is officially acting as a municipal court judge and is authorized to conduct such actions for the state. Judge Beach denied the motion to exclude the search warrant. Also appearing before the court at the pretrial hearing was a slew of forensic scientists, all fascinating but certainly over my head a lot of the time. Mallory Pagenkop, forensic biologist and DNA analyst from Serological Research Institute in Richmond, California, testified via Zoom or Zoom-type video conferencing software. Serological, or Siri for short, identified male DNA on Carla's bra and created an extract, later uploaded to CODIS with no hits. Pagenkop described her and Siri's role in the Carla Walker case. John Fonden, lab director at Othram Incorporated, took the stand and described their role, including identifying McCurley and phoning Detective Jeff Bennett on July 4th, 2020, to give him the name they had found. They were a little worried they'd be bothering the detective during a holiday, Fonden said. To the contrary, Detective Bennett was more than happy to hear the results, and he was absolutely elated when he heard the name, because he knew it. He told the guys at Othram to hold on while he grabbed the file. "I don't know if he sleeps with that file or what," Othram's John Fonden said on the stand. Dr. Bruce Badoli, member of the Texas Forensic Science Commission, was next up on the stand. Dr. Badoli is kind of a big deal, a University of North Texas professor and ex-FBI senior scientist at Quantico, Virginia. Dr. Badoli has been in genetics for decades. "I'm not going to go into the DNA stuff now for a couple reasons. McCurley's defense is working hard to get the DNA evidence thrown out. They claim the trash retrieved from McCurley's trash bin, which was out for pickup, falls under illegal search and seizure. This is perhaps the best chance they've got to suppress evidence, as there seems to be a ton of legal gray area concerning this very thing." McCurley's defense asked Judge Beach for some time to get their bearings concerning their motion to exclude the DNA evidence, but we'll see. We'll be back to update y'all when that happens. It was around 3 p.m., a little after, I think, when court adjourned. This was a good day for the state of Texas versus Glenn Samuel McCurley, and it feels like justice for Carla is on the horizon. Thanks for listening, y'all.